everyone. Thank you for joining us today. This is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik. We are glad to have you with us here today. We're preparing for a live TV show on April 30th, Valpurgis Night, our 10-year Red Eyes Radio anniversary. A lot of fun little kinks, technically speaking, that we are working out right now. We're also finalizing our new website in the background of everything, so if you do notice that the news updates are a tad bit slower than usual on redeyescreations.com, now you know why, so thank you for your patience. We'll have more information about the live show on the websites as we move forward into next week, so stay tuned for that. Well, as you might know, we like to discuss history on this show, accurate history, and if there is a period of history that is more important than others, I guess it would be 20th century history around the two world wars that reformed so much of Europe and the world. We're living in the shadow of these world wars, and it has a grip on us today, which prevents us fully from actualizing who we are and what we actually could do. So today we're going to take a deeper look at one of the most influential characters that helped to define the post-World War period, Winston Churchill. Mike King is our guest. He's been with us before on the show. He's a private investigative journalist and a researcher based in the New York City area, a 1987 graduate of Rutgers University. King's subsequent 27-year career in marketing and advertising has equipped him with a unique perspective when it comes to understanding how public opinion is scientifically manufactured. Mike has recently released The British Mad Dog, Debunking the Mythology of Winston Churchill, and that's our topic today. Mr. King, welcome back to Red Ice Radio. It was a pleasure speaking with you. It was almost a year ago since we had you on the show. We were just talking before we started here that it's going by way too fast. I can't believe it's almost been a year since we spoke, but there you have it. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's been too long. We'll have to address that. Lots to talk about. I've had three new publications since that time.
Yeah, exactly. You keep plugging out the books at a fast pace, Mike. Tons of research, and of course you keep up with the work on tomatobubble.com as well, your website. A lot of good stories and articles that come my way through, I think through your newsletter, some really good stories that we sometimes link to and repost on Red Ice. But, okay, so there's a number of books we want to talk a bit about here. I definitely want to speak a bit more about Napoleon and his struggle, if you will, and maybe we'll save that for the second segment, but let's begin with Churchill. You've released a book called The British Mad Dog, Debunking the Myth of Winston Churchill. Give us a bit of the backstory of the book and why you wanted to write it.
Well, as you know, I've written extensively about World War II and Hitler in that era. So obviously I already had quite a base of knowledge about Mr. Churchill, who has been lionized as the British Bulldog, but I call him the British Mad Dog. And I really felt there was a need to take down this fraud. I mean, the man is a living lie. And that's what I sought to do in my book. But not just to cover the fraud of World War II, I trace back what I call the insanity, and I mean that truly in a literal sense, of Winston Churchill back to his childhood. So I actually touch upon his grandparents and his father and his mother. I mean, my goodness, what a horror show. And, you know, I don't put this stuff in here to be salacious or provocative, but I felt it was important to lay the groundwork of the man's childhood and what he came from and his screwed up parents. Because then you get better, if you understand the child, you better understand the man. And all throughout his life, he just manifested some of the most psychotic behavior patterns. He's truly a type of character who was fit for an insane asylum. And only in the modern world would someone like that come to power and be lionized, literally. I mean, the title of one of his most famous biographies is The Last Lion, but he was anything but a lion. He was just a degenerate, impulsive, compulsive psychopath full of personality disorders who brought his country to ruin, and not just World War II, but every previous job he held prior to that. Everything was handed to him on a silver platter because of his family background. And I was astonished to learn so much of this stuff, all of his record of disasters. I mean, everything he touched turned to crap. And it's, right. It's incredible. Yeah. This goes back to World War I. It goes back. He did a stint as Secretary of the Exchequer, which would be the equivalent of Secretary of the Treasury, and he crashed the British economy. I mean, it just goes on and on. I was just shocked to learn how bad his story is. And indeed, it got so bad at one point that he was essentially exiled from the British public scene. And they call these the wilderness years. But it was so bad that in spite of his connections, nobody wanted anything to do with him. So he spent at least a decade just out in the wilderness. Nobody wanted anything to do with him or offer him any kind of government post. But it was the big shot Jews who engineered World War II that brought him back from the political graveyard. So it's a fascinating story from start to finish, and it's one more so than any other book I've written in which I've learned so many things that I didn't even expect to learn.
I don't know about that much about his background, to be honest, and I do want to get into that a little bit more in detail, actually, and run through some of the chronology here, really, before we talk about, of course, what we remember him for today and his legacy and the way that he's been lifted up in the official world, if you will. But can you talk to us a little bit about the Churchill family and where they come from? This is, I guess, really sets the backdrop then of the fact that he rose to the position that he did, right?
Well, yes. I mean, he comes from 250 years, quarter of a millennium of family privilege. They weren't aristocrats, but they were very important politically. It goes back to Sir Winston Churchill in the 1600s. You can't choose your ancestors, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with coming from that background. But we find so often in history that these blue blood types, after a few generations, they really tend to degenerate and become out of touch with reality. So, I mean, he was born into immense privilege, a very important family, the Spencer Churchills. And by the way, that's the same Spencers that Lady Diana derived from.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you talk about blue blood, silver spoon in the mouth. I mean, that is Churchill. But, you know, more recently, we go back to his grandparents, his American grandparents. His grandfather, Leonard Jerome, was known as the King of Wall Street. And he was hooked up with August Belmont back then and the Morgans and the Rothschilds. So he was there. We're going back to the late 1800s, or mid-1800s. The Churchill family, well, this is on the mother's side, the Jerome family, was part of New York High Society. His mother was a New York City socialite who, even by today's standards of immorality, you would have to just call her, can we say slut? I mean, it was just incredible. This woman slept with so many princes. There's rumors that it numbers in the dozens, but I've been able to confirm at least six or seven princes. I mean, she got around, that was his mother. She slept with numerous princes, and it is doubtful as to who Winston Churchill's real father actually was. There's a Yugoslavian historian who, according to her original research, she clearly establishes that at the same time that she was with Churchill's alleged father, who was a prominent politician in Britain, that she was sleeping with this Serbian prince. And she claims that that's a real father. And I have pictures in the book, and he does resemble this man more so than he does his real father. But his mother was just a really vain socialite basket case of a woman. His father, Lord Randolph Churchill, was a prominent politician in the day. He is believed to have died of syphilis himself. So it's really a freak show. You go through this.
Yep.
And again, I point this out because I want to show just what a troubled young boy he was. And I think that's where we can trace the root of his insanity. And indeed, to carpet bomb the city of Dresden like he did, this is the work of an insane person.
Right. Yeah.
So now, as a child, and Churchill himself writes about this, about the pain that he felt of being neglected. They sent him away to elite private schools. His mother never came to visit. We know this from Churchill himself. He hated it there. He begged his mom to visit, but she's all over Europe sleeping around with various princes. His father was a very control freak, abusive type, who basically thought of Winston as a dummy and was always putting him down. And you know, he never came to visit either. So, I mean, by the time Winston comes out of the private military school, boarding school that he attended, I mean, he's just someone who's just deprived of the love of his father and the physical affection of his mother. And, you know, I truly believe that that shaped the monster that we know him to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he became in later years.
He's born, by the way, for those who don't know, 1874, and of course, Britain, as many countries at that time, is going through a lot of upheaval, obviously, somewhat tumultuous times overall, really latching on from the industrial period and then reformation of a lot of the political systems and rise of new political ideologies and stuff like that. But what is it that... What gets him into politics eventually? I don't want to jump ahead too fast of ourselves here, but he obviously when he grows up he develops an interest for this, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, he has this entitlement mentality given the class that he's come from, so he at a young age he has political ambitions, but you know, to lay the groundwork for his political career, he first has to accomplish something in life. So his mother, through her connections, secures for him some very cushy writing assignments as a war correspondent. So he goes to Sudan. He spent some time in India, South Africa during the Boer War. So he's a young man in his 20s, and he's writing these articles, and because of the connections, you know, they're widely read throughout England, so he becomes well-known. I mean, the Churchill name is already well-known, but now he becomes well-known as a war correspondent. And there is evidence that he has embellished the degree of danger that he was in as a war correspondent. I mean, we see this today. I mean, years ago, I remember, you know, Geraldo Rivera, prominent American journalist, He was a war correspondent, embedded journalist, and he would always come up with these tales about the danger he was in. you know how that goes.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, wasn't it something, was it Brian Williams that was talking about how he was on some helicopter or something, that was
right.
Something that came out, and it was all a fraud and fake, and this is just what they do, right? Even back then, they started doing it.
Oh, yeah, Teddy Roosevelt, the whole myth of San Juan Hill, it's a long history of this. These sons of the elite class, in order to build a name for themselves, they go off to war, but they're certainly not going to put themselves in danger.
No.
But they They find a way to make heroes of themselves. Now, during the Boer War, Churchill and his unit are captured by the Boers of South Africa. And they're held in a prison. It's actually an old school. And Churchill, the only one, mind you, he quote-unquote escapes, and they make such a big deal of this in Britain. He basically comes home to a hero's welcome. He supposedly evaded the prison guards and then swam across the river, put himself in danger. Now, I was able to track down for this book through a connection the grandson of a man who tells the real story of his so-called escape. Essentially, some big people bought his freedom, and the guards were told just to stand down. One of the prisoners is just going to walk through a fence, pretend you don't see what's happening. And then Churchill had some helpers there, and he was given a horse, and the river that he swam across is basically like 6 inches deep. So I mean, the whole thing was embellished, but by the time he came home, he was a rock star. and he used that to win, barely win, a seat in the British Parliament as a conservative, as a quote-unquote conservative.
Was it the Tories that was around then, or was that something else back then?
You know, I don't know if they referred to themselves as Tory. Probably was.
Yeah, all right.
You know, but he won a seat. And then immediately after winning a seat, he takes off on a speaking tour of England, Canada, and the United States, and he earns the equivalent in modern day of many millions of dollars on a speaking tour. So, you know, sort of reminds me of Hillary Clinton, who gets paid $250,000 a speech, you know.
Jeez.
So yeah. Even back then, when you were connected, you know, that's the kind of things that happened. So he made a fortune. So he came from money. He made a oh, by the way, while he was writing these articles as a war correspondent, he was one of the highest paid journalists in England, which is incredible. He's still in his early 20s, and he's writing books and articles, giving speeches. He is a money-making machine.
Who gives him these gigs then?
Well, they're coming through the influence of the mother.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And also his father's name. So that's how it works in those circles. You make a few phone calls. Well, back then they didn't have telephones. But, you know, again, his mother is the daughter of the man who was the king of Wall Street. So he's connected. He also joined the Freemasons as a young man.
Yep.
So many good things happening for the British Mad Dog, and he's moving up fast. So that's how he was elected to, you know, the Parliament as an MP.
And he does some speaking, as you said.
Speaking earns many, many millions of pounds.
And then what happens? What happens next? I don't know if we're up by the Great War already, but he enters into politics. Does he climb on that ladder, or what happens next?
You know, he was barely elected, and then he lost his re-election. There was a period of time where he kept switching parties. He went from conservative to liberal so he could run again, and then he lost. Then he had to go from liberal to a new party, Constitutionalist Party, and then he lost. And then and at the same time he's switching parties, he's switching constituencies or districts. And then eventually he switches back to conservative. So the man has no principles. He switched from conservative to liberal to constitutionalist back to conservative. It's called crossing the aisle in Great Britain.
Yeah.
But he could not win. He couldn't win a seat. People saw through him. So it was only through the appointment, the government positions, that he really began to establish a political career. And then finally he could win a seat back. In Britain, you could be a member of parliament and hold a high-level cabinet position at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something else that most people have forgotten, how many times he switched parties and switched districts. He was just obsessed with getting into government, because that's what these people do, Heinrich. I mean, they're really useless, some of these elites. I mean, he was a horrible student, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom out of his class, always. Accomplished nothing in life. You know, he had a few writing gigs handed to him. I mean, he was a decent writer, but that's no big deal, because everybody in Britain, you know, back then learned to speak and write well. So, I mean, there's no skill, there's no accomplishment at all. And yet, here he is on the eve of the Great War now. He is the first Lord of the British Admiralty. So he's the head of the Navy. And he's still a young man, maybe early 30s.
And he was, he was put in that position by the government at that time.
By appointment. So somebody's pulling strings. You know, give this kid a job.
Yeah.
Again, the kind of stuff we see today with the likes of a Barack Obama or a Marco Rubio. I mean, these absolute nobodies who barely even make it through school, never have jobs, and then they're placed on this skyrocketing career path. It's incredible.
Yeah, look at Rubio. We don't have to go off topic too much, but it's incredible. It's like, who's this kid, right? Where does he come from? And just like straight in and running for president right away. That's amazing.
Just this little homosexual boy who ran for state.
His foam parties, right? Going in his foam parties in Miami.
Yeah, he was in debt up to his eyeballs, had no money, no connections, And the next thing you know, he was the leading candidate for a while for a president. But the point is, it's the same then as it is today.
Yeah. All right. So let's move forward here in the chronology and see what happens now. Is it? Tell us about his involvement then in the war.
Well, so here we are. We're on the eve of the Great War, and you could, in my book, The Bad War, I go into that in depth. Both world wars, actually. So without getting too much into the war itself, staying relevant to Churchill, the important thing to understand is that in the early days, actually the early hours of the war, he was one of the main protagonists to get this started. And he had a lot of power as head of the British Admiralty. And there's a quote I'd like to read from you. It's from the Prime Minister of Britain. He was Prime Minister at the outbreak of the Great War. Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith, who was not really too crazy about the idea of going through with this war. There was still time to stop it in the first few days. But he writes about an early cabinet meeting. He says, Winston was very bellicose and demanding immediate mobilization. He has got all of his war paint on and is longing for a sea fight in the early hours of the morning to result in the sinking of the Goeben, German ship. The whole thing fills me with sadness. So, you know, I mean, we know Churchill's role, World War II, what a warmonger he was, but it's going back to World War I as one of the key members. And remember, you know, when you're talking about the British military, you're talking about the Navy. That's really what they command. So his power was immense. So, in a sense, Churchill was able to get the war started on his own, with or without Prime Minister Asquith. But he was one of the most bloodthirsty warmongers in the early hours of that war that should never have happened. Germany was pleading, just like they were in World War II. You know, let's not do this. This is madness. But you had people like Churchill mobilizing the Navy.
Do we know anything about what motivated him? And did he, as an individual, have a lot of influence then in the decision-making and what to do?
He was a key player. I mean, he wasn't the overall architect of this design to bring about World War One. I mean, that you have to go back to the 1890s. That was already in play. So he was just one of the operatives, the apparatchiks. But he was in an important enough role that he could you know, serve his masters and deliver this war almost on his own. Not unlike, by the way, not unlike Naval Secretary Theodore Roosevelt, who got the Spanish-American War going pretty much on his own. I mean, there's a whole story there. So he was a key player in triggering it, but he was not, you know, the overall master. And then early on in this war, Churchill, now, the German hunger blockade of World War One is fairly well known by people who study history. You could Google it, German hunger blockade, World War One, how terrible it was. And it was unprecedented, Henrik. At that time in Europe, it was understood you don't make war against civilians.
Right.
Any civilians who ever died in European wars prior to that were of an unintended consequences, you know, disease and things like that.
Mm.
But this was a deliberate decision on the part of Secretary, Lord of the Admiralty Churchill, to starve German civilians. Google it, the German hunger blockade. So much has been...
Even back then, huh?
Even back then. And over the course of the war, it is estimated that 750,000 German civilians, mainly vulnerable women, children, elderly, they succumbed to malnutrition and hunger and the diseases associated with it. So this was a brutal method of war. Food deliveries were designated as contraband. Okay? So it wasn't like a blockade to prevent the importation of industrial goods or anything that could be used to enhance the military. No, they labeled food. This is the British Navy under Churchill as contraband. So this monster is the architect of the German hunger blockade. And like I said, although the blockade is no secret, it is amazing how the historians kind of have edited out who the architect of the blockade.
That's right.
Was,
yeah.
You know.
Amazing. I had no idea actually that this happened. And Germany, I guess, still had access to the Baltic, but that you know obviously they couldn't ship in from that area as much as it would do from the west side, if you will, towards Britain, right?
Right. It created a horrible shortage, so they're basically cut off of anything that would come from the North Sea or the Baltic.
Yeah.
So you know, you had to get all your foodstuffs from land, but you know, you have a distribution system set up to accommodate a certain number of people. And all of a sudden, you cut that in whatever, whether it's a third or half, people are going to starve.
Yeah. Extraordinary. Yep, never heard about it.
Yeah.
So obviously, that's incentive for opposition here between these forces already. But let's stick to Churchill here. We've talked about this, Mike, in terms of the wars and what causes them and the outbreak of them. But let's stick to Churchill's kind of role in this, really, and what you think that, you know, incentivizes him to push things. I mean, is there any evidence at this stage that someone is encouraging him behind the scenes to do this and that? You mentioned, of course, that he joins Freemasonry early. I think the year you have in the book is 1904. Powerful group. We've spoken at great lengths about the Freemasons in the past, although we haven't detailed that much about them in more recent show, but we're very savvy to Freemasonry. How
right.
How influential do you think they are in the kind of suggesting him to go this or that way?
Well, at this point in history, it's difficult to say, or at least it was difficult for me to discern. I mean, I'm sure he was under influence of globalists and Freemasons and Jews and things like that. But it's a little different than it was in World War II. With World War II, and I get into this later in the book, we have documentary evidence, confirmed by Jewish sources, no less, of the big money that was being given to Churchill during the run-up to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He was broke. They bailed him out personally, millions and millions of dollars. I mean, he was their boy. And that we can, you know, fully document and illustrate. With World War One, we know he was a major player in bringing it about. We know he was a bloodthirsty warmonger. You know, the links are, I guess, a little bit more vague. But certainly, someone as cunning as Churchill knew that the key to rising in the political structure of the day was in playing the globalists and the Zionist game, which was already in force at that time. I mean, they really wanted World War One. But as far as, like, direct evidence of conversations or payouts to Churchill, that I'm not able to document. But clearly, he knew who he was serving.
Yeah, we're left to speculate on that point. Tell us, as we lead up to it, I want you to talk about his wilderness years, as you call them in the book, and what led up to that? What was it that brought him to that point?
What happened was, in spite of his connections and his magical protection from above, his colossal failures, both as a Lord of the Admiralty, he was demoted during World War One because of the disasters that he engineered. It's all in the book, Dogger's Bank, Gallipoli. The man was absolutely reckless in terms of his strategy. And there's this pattern. It's nothing like I've ever seen. I mean, it's more than evil. He was insane. He had it in his mind that he could just send the British Navy off and capture Turkey. And I mean, everything he touched ended in failure. So they had to keep reassigning him. And it was just failure, 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 always demonstrating that same psychopathic characteristic of impulsiveness. He never thought through his actions. He just acted recklessly. And I get into it later in the book that he was a heavy, heavy drinker. He was an alcoholic. He was drunk all the time. It's like putting a drunk, someone who is like 10 times over the legal limit, behind the wheel of a race car during the Indianapolis 500. And so you had this pattern. So eventually, you know, they had to send him away. You know, I mean, he kept his parliament seat, but that was it. He was out of the loop. Then what happened is sometime during the mid-20s, early 20s, they brought him back in again. They made him Secretary of the Exchequer, Secretary of the Treasury. Now, this is a man who, throughout his life, in spite of earning the modern-day equivalent of tens of millions of dollars, was always broken in debt. I mean, he...
How's that possible?
it is incredible.
Reckless spending.
It's spending on a par with some of these professional American athletes that you read about. They excel at the sport, and they have these multi-million-dollar contracts for 10, 15, 20 years. And then you read about them. By age 50, they're broke.
Hookers and blow, yeah.
And well, that was Churchill. With Churchill, it was the highest-priced Havana cigars, which he chain-smoked.
Yeah.
At least a dozen a day. Always had a cigar in his hand.
Yeah,
cigars probably in modern-day, you know, they might be $100 a piece in modern-day value. The most expensive champagne, brandy. He liked to dress well. Everything was tailored. An immense wardrobe. He liked to travel. He liked the casinos in Monte Carlo. He played Wall Street as if it was a casino. There's actually a book written about this by a British historian. We're talking mainstream British historian, regular publisher and everything. And you know what's interesting, Henrik? There is so much dirt on Churchill from so many different areas of his life and his career that is put out by mainstream British establishment historians.
Right.
But
okay.
It's always in the context of, well, he was a great man, he was a heroic figure, but he had this one little problem of his character. And then you have another guy who takes the same, but you put it all together. But I guess they have to present it that way. They have to keep the myth of Churchill the Great alive. So that's how they present it. Churchill was great, but he drank. And the other guy will write, Churchill was great, but he spent himself into bankruptcy. And another guy will write, Churchill was great, but he was abusive towards women.
Well, he's become the symbol, obviously, of really the guy who defeated Hitler, right? I mean, that's really what he's, I mean, not alone, we know that, but even on a mainstream level, that he's the guy who was there. He did it. He was instrumental. His speeches, of course,
right?
That they talk so much about how incredibly inspiring they were, and yeah, while he was just drunk, you know. But it's really a massive myth again, as usual with these many of these characters, that they have built up and that they hand over to the masses as the champions and the heroes of the people.
Yeah, that's what it is. It is a mythology. And the reason they can't fully tear this man down, they have to maintain him as a full hero, is because, as you said, he defeated the big bag monster, Hitler. Or at least, you know, he kept Britain in the fight long enough until help could arrive.
Right. Yeah.
But then again, now in my book, I don't play that game. I directly confront and defuse the lie that Germany was responsible for World War II. And that actually was the likes of Churchill who brought that disaster about. But that's the reason why they, in spite of all the dirt that comes out about him, they have to keep him up there as a hero.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, the guy was toxic. He was an untouchable, and they brought him back. Now, mind you, we talked about how he spent himself into oblivion, tens of millions of dollars, and he's the Secretary of the Treasury. you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
And now, what does he do as Secretary of the Chancellor of the Exchequer? He crashes the British economy, and this is something I had not known. In 1926, he engineered the immediate cold turkey transition of the British pound back to the gold standard. And he did this against the advice of economists left and right. And what they did is they fixed the value of the pound back to what it was like in 1910 or something. Not to get too much into a discussion of banking and economics, but gold standard is a good thing. It's better than paper currency.
Sure.
However, when you're going to transition to it from a paper money standard, it's a delicate procedure because you still have all of the old debts that have been accumulated, and now all of a sudden you make your currency so strong, there's literally not enough to repay the old debt. You have a deflationary crash. In short, it's just like if you're getting someone off of a drug, someone who's been on heroin for years, you just don't say, okay, no more heroin. You'll kill the patient. But again, he manifested that reckless disregard. You had conservative economists and you had liberal economists like the legendary John Maynard Keynes who are saying this is madness, don't go about it this way.
Mm-hmm.
But Churchill did, and it was a catastrophic crash in 1926. And someone actually killed themselves in front of Churchill's Treasury office in order to send them a message, look what you did to me.
Oh, really? Wow.
So, everything he touched turned to crap. Now, the economic crisis that he engineered triggered a massive general strike, and Churchill had a solution for that too. He wanted to gun down the strikers and the protesters. These were his own people, British people, and luckily cooler heads prevailed. They reached some kind of compromise with the strikers, and the strike ended after 8 or 9 days. But if they would have started shooting down people, who knows what hell would have broken loose.
Right, exactly.
So this was a colossal disaster, and this led to the real wilderness year. So there was a period of time where they kind of pushed him aside, but then somebody put him back in. But now, after that, he was really persona non grata. So people have to understand what was behind the wilderness years. There's even a big book was written called The Wilderness Years.
Right.
It wasn't that people didn't appreciate the prophecy of Winston Churchill, who was always claiming that there was an enemy to go to war against. No, the guy was just a total loser. It's just absolute toxic. He would be like the Boris Yeltsin of Great Britain at that time. It's like, get out of here. And that's The Wilderness Years. So basically from 27 or 28 until the late 1930s, he retains a seat, but he's just a backbencher in Parliament. He writes some articles. But it seems like he's done. But he's not done. There are powerful people who have use of such an asset, and he was an asset for the right people.
Do you think it was his alcoholism, his kind of megalomaniac behavior, his utter recklessness that kind of made him a good target to use, maybe both for blackmail, extortion purposes, but also the fact that he wouldn't really know what he was doing, so it was easily controllable and manageable?
Absolutely. It's a number of factors. First of all, you have this rejected, lonely, angry, anxious little boy. Remains a little boy all through his life, but he has to show that he's a big shot. So that is a personality characteristic that the globalists find very useful. When you find somebody who has to make his mark like that, add to that the alcoholism, add to that the apparent homosexuality. I get into that in the book too. There's a whole other story there. The reckless, callous disregard for human life. The elitism, the condescending elite, all of it. He's the perfect candidate. He's like a modern day, Obama, only much worse. So that's the way it works. When you manifest that kind of degeneracy and even lunacy, it's actually advantageous to someone looking to advance a political career.
What can you say about his gay activities? I didn't know about this. I think I've heard the rumors here or there, but again, this is at a time when these things are very volatile because it becomes a security issue. There was a reason why they kept this out of the political system, and they frowned on this for many reasons, of course, but one of them was because many of these people became a liability because it could be used against them and extortion and stuff like that, right?
Well, oh yeah. So, you know, and certainly because of some of the, you know, the high level homosexuals that he was linked to, you know, the big boys, the masters of the New World Order knew about this. They had to. I quote extensively from the work of a mainstream British historian called Michael Block, who wrote a book called Closet Queens. And it's a history of homosexuality amongst the British elite going back to the 1800s.
Is that book like written from a perspective today that is like they were such a shame that they had to be in the closet kind of thing?
Poor heroes, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's important to note that the author is not in any way hostile or dismissive of that behavior.
Sure.
His point of view is, well, now that we live in an enlightened society, we can talk about this stuff. So that's why I'm writing it.
They're really that shows even more that they're true heroes, right? True underdogs of their era, and they were the society was so repressed and suppressive at the time that they had to hide, right?
Yeah. Right. So you know, I mean the word queen sounds derogatory, but the book itself is not. It's just a portrayal of what you know, what was. And he's not condemning at all. He's just saying, you know, isn't it wonderful? We're so enlightened today. Now we can talk about it. But he makes a very strong case for Churchill's homosexuality. He was also a woman hater, a misogynist. He was very rude. Some of the nasty stuff he used to say to women. Maybe there's some kind of latent resentment towards his mother, which one could understand. You know, he's not even sure who his real father was. His brother Jack, according to the sisters of the mother, Jenny Jerome, Jack was not born to Lord Randolph Churchill either. Also, when she remarried, she married after Lord Randolph died, and then she remarried to a man who was a year younger than Winston Churchill, and divorced him, and then married another man 4 years younger than Churchill. I mean, so she's really a really bizarre, wacky woman. But I think, again, you know, we played a role of amateur psychologist. This can account for some of Churchill's, you know, misogyny. I mean, there's just instances of the way he used to talk to women. I mean, there's that famous quote, which everyone laughs about. It was a member of Parliament that said, you know, Sir Winston, you are very drunk. And Churchill responds, yes, but you are very ugly. The difference is, tomorrow I'll be sober, you'll still be ugly. And I've heard that quote a million times, and I think it was voted one of the greatest political quotes ever. But when you really think about it, yes, it does make you laugh at first, but think about it. I mean, what does it say about the man? Suppose someone said that to your mother or your wife.
Sure. Yep.
All she said is, my God, you're drunk. And he was always drunk.
Yeah.
And he said publicly, well, you're ugly, and you'll still be ugly tomorrow. It's just an all around degenerate, nasty, just no redeeming value to this man. At all. It's just incredible. You've got to read this book, The British Mad Dog. Find it at tomatobubble.com.
Yeah, it's so often with many of these people that they put in front of us, you know, they have so many issues, and it's not just that they have some, you know, issues here and there. These are like utterly reckless human beings, and their behavior is obviously something that can be used against them. That occurs so many times. Let's just kind of get into what happens a little bit during the whatever you feel is pertinent. There's a lot of things around this period, of course, but we have the lead up to the Second World War and all that stuff. How does he comes back into politics again? Is there anything in particular that kind of saves him out of the wilderness years, or this is just back end deals and they just decide to put him in there again, and here we go, another round for Churchill?
Well, by the mid 30s, he is flat broke, busted. I mean, he's got tax collectors beating down his door, tailors are suing him, he has no money. I mean, and again, mainstream British historian wrote a book called No More Champagne, which goes into this. He's another one of these characters. He was a great man. He saved the world, but So he's broke, so of course he's vulnerable. Men like Bernard Baruch swooped in, and they bailed him out. Henry Strakosch, a big shot, billionaire Jew, straight up gave him millions of pounds. I mean, straight payments. So this is going, he's being bought in the mid-30s by the very same people who are already angling for a war with Germany. And I tell you, Henrik, if it wasn't for these Jewish billionaires, I believe Churchill could have wound up homeless on the streets like a bum. I mean, that's how bad it was. I've got a picture in the book. It shows the he had a big fancy hot tub in his home, and he's sitting in there in a it looks like a lawn chair with a couple of aides. They're sitting in the pool. It's empty. It was empty because he could no longer afford to heat the water. They had to shut the heat off. So, and you know, he's known nothing but, you know, big spending and luxury all his life. So how easy was it to buy a man like this?
Yeah.
And that's what they did. It's all in my book, enormous sums of payment. Now, he pays off on the investment in 1935. He begins to, by writing an article for Strand magazine. Now you have to understand, at this time, some of the anti-Hitler propaganda has died down because all of the early atrocity stories from 33, 34, they've proven to be false. Germany hasn't threatened anybody. The economy is rebounding and booming. So Hitler is considered pretty much a heroic figure throughout Europe.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
Churchill had to tread carefully when he wrote this article in 35. And he actually speculates that Hitler might go down in history as a heroic figure along the lines of Pericles or George Washington. Churchill writes this.
Really?
But he has to, because he has to give some credibility to the article. But then he throws in the poison pill. He says, but we don't know what the future may bring. He could be another Attila the Hun. So, you know, we see now the role that Churchill has is to begin the drumbeat that's going to lead towards World War II. And this article is later republished again in 1937. And the details of all this are in my book, The Bad War. And I also reproduce quite a bit of it in The British Mad Dog. So there's this heavy, definitely this heavy buildup towards the war. We all know that.
Yeah.
But it's clear that Churchill is being kept on the back burner. That they have things in store for him, even though he's still in the wilderness.
Now, do you think, is it the billionaires, the Jewish billionaires within Britain at the time that make sure that he ends up in this position and that they can, I guess they would figure that when they've had something like the rise of Hitler in Germany at the time, they're starting to look to other countries there. What can we do to make sure that we contain this issue and this problem? Right, that they make sure that Winston is in there, he's in power, also make sure that he, as much as possible, is keeping the rhetoric, you know, against, as you said, Hitler, because then you have a change of tune, you said, from 1935 up to 1937, right? It changes at that point, is that correct?
Yeah, right. It begins to change. There was, I mean, when Hitler first came to power in 33, the world press went nuts, and there were all these stories about he's killing Jews, and people are being tortured. But, you know, that kind of passed. People saw, well, no, it's not really true. He's not bothering anybody. Germany's rebuilding. So then you get into 34, 35, 36, and they host the Olympics in 36. Nobody in Europe wants war. Well, the big planners do. But, you know, certainly the current crop of political leadership in Britain isn't looking for war. So they have to get their little puppet boy and position him. So that's what's happening. They bought him. And then in 1935, we got a chunk of money. 1936, and I've got this all in the book, and I quote extensively from the great David Irving. There was a Jewish organization called The Focus, and it was funded by super wealthy Jews, Sir Robert Mond. He was the director of chemical firms. Sir Robert Whaley Cohen. There was Strachak. Then Bernard Baruch also helped him. And by this time, we're talking direct payments to Churchill to bail him out.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, there was it Churchill's War that David Irving wrote, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's all in Churchill's War. Then again, in 1938, he collects another cool $1 million from Sir Henry Strakosch. The connection to Strakosch to Churchill was made through Lord Bracken, who Block identifies as a homosexual lover of Churchill. So, I mean, these are overt payments going to Churchill to not only enrich, but not to enrich him, mind you. This just got him up to sea level. He was so underwater. I mean, it's just incredible. This only got him to sea level. But they owned him, not just for reasons of greed, but his spending was such that it was for his very survival. He needed the money of these mega billionaire big shot Jewish gangsters who wanted World War II.
Well, let's actually pick up that after the break and talk a bit more about what we should know going into this period of when the war begins, really, and then we can work ourselves forward from there. Talk a bit about his speeches and who wrote them and everything else we should know there. But okay, so the book here that we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is The British Mad Dog: Debunking the Myth of Winston Churchill by Mike King. Tell us not only how to get a copy of this book, but you have a couple of others out since the time we had you on the show last time, and we'll see if we can squeeze in and speak some more about those later in the second segment as well. But give us some of the other titles that you have out there now.
Well, I've got quite a few. I would say my magnum opus is Planet Rothschild, Volume 1 and 2, which covers the last 250 years of the New World Order conspiracy. It's in a very fast reading, easy to understand timeline format with tons of images. All my works are very, very readable. People, it's not like your conventional history book that you pick up with the intention of reading, but you never get around to it. People devour my books, I have to be honest. Then there's The Bad War, The Real Story of World War II, which also covers World War I in depth. There's The War Against Putin. Bankarata, which is an allegory about our monetary policy. It's all listed at tomatobubble.com. You can get a glimpse at all the books. I have an Amazon page that's under M.S. King. But probably the best bet, people who are interested, is to go to tomatobubble.com. You can sign up for my free updates, and you can see all of the books that are available as pay-per-view PDFs, or you can order them in paperback form through Amazon.
Very good, Mike. Excellent. Tomatobubble.com, Amazon.com. We'll have the links up to that. Looking forward to speaking more with you here in the next segment. A lot of important things to get to. We'll see if we can get talking a bit about Napoleon as well in the second, but let's definitely stick to Churchill here. A lot of interesting aspects to that. All right, stay with us. Short break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after that.
The very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England and the coast of vice historical, from Marathon to Waterloo, in order categorical. I am very well acquainted too with matters mathematical. I understand equations both the simple and quadratical. About fundamental theorem, I am teeming with a lot of news. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. I am very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of beings and animalculus. In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general. I know our mythic history, King Arthur's and Sir Caradoc's. To answer how the crossings have a pretty taste for paradox. It could in elegiacs all the crimes of Helicabalus. In conic seconds, globularities parabolous. I can tell and that of Raphael some Derrida's and Sophonies. I know the croaking chorus and the frogs of Aristophanes, and I can hum a fugue which you've heard the music's dinner for. Ooh, dinner for. Ha-ha! And whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense, Pinafore.
And whistle all the airs
Then I can write a washing bill in Babylonic uniform and tell you every detail of Caractacus's uniform. In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general. In fact, when I know what is meant by mammalian and ravelin, when I can tell at sight about a rifle from a javelin, when such affairs of sorties and surprises I'm more wary at, and when I know precisely what is meant by commissariat, when I have learned that progress has been made in modern gunnery, when I know more of tactics than a novice in a nunnery, in short, I have a smattering of elemental strategy. Ooh, strategy. Strategy, letter, strategy. Ah, I have it. You'll serve as a major general and never sat you. For my military knowledge, though I am plucky and adventurous, has only been but down to the beginning of the century, but still in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general.
Our second hour is next up with Mike King. Don't miss it as we proceed to talk about Winston Churchill, his life, and the world that he left behind. We have much more to get into, a very interesting history that remains hidden to most of us. We'll also get Mike's take on Britain today and what is happening on the small island with the Anglo-Saxon Celtic heritage being pushed out by invading forces. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up when you want to hear the second hour of this program or any of our previous ones. Over 1,000 shows in our archives, including videos and film material, inside episodes, and more. Our upcoming guests include John Morgan from Arctos and also our part two with Frank Raymond. I know a lot of you liked the first, so a part two is queued up on that. Good stuff ahead. Thank you so much for listening. RedIceMembers.com is the website. Go there for a membership, and we'll talk to you right after the break.